Yossi Klein Halevi is an American-born writer who lives in Jerusalem. He is a public intellectual, and much of his focus is on the interfaith relations of Jews, Christians, and Muslims. This summer, my friend Jason Fenster, who is a rabbi here in Deerfield, recommended that I read Halevi's Letters to My Palestinian Neighbor. I found much of the writing in this book beautiful and moving, an attempt to bridge two communities whose differences have often led to bloody violence. The conclusion of the book is a letter written on Sukkot, the Festival of Booths. This is the holiday that many of our Jewish siblings are celebrating today and through this next week. And so I'd like to offer some of what Halevi wrote in that letter. He says this: "Dear neighbor, it is the holiday of Sukkot, the festival of booths, when Jews build temporary shacks as extensions of our homes. The holiday recalls the journey of the Israelites through the desert on their way to this land, and the shacks evoke the structures that sheltered them in their wanderings. For a full week, the sukkah becomes a surrogate home in which we eat and host friends and study Torah and sometimes even sleep." Halevi continues his letter, looking out to the next hill where this hypothetical Palestinian neighbor lives. He writes, "My family builds its sukkah on our porch facing your hill. Perhaps you can see the fragile structure from your home, poles holding up a roof of palm branches laid on wooden slats with walls of printed cloth. The side of our sukkah facing your hill is left entirely open. And so throughout the week, I live with a heightened sense of intimacy between our hills. In the morning, I hear the cries of Palestinian children playing in the schoolyard." He goes on, "The sukkah is a reminder of fragility, of transience, and yet leaving the comfort of one's home for the holiday also implies a trust in the benign nature of the world, in something like divine protection. And so in the Jewish imagination, the sukkah is a symbol of a redeemed world where human beings have lived with each other in peace and will go forward doing so. Spread your sukkah of peace on us, we say. Spread your sukkah of peace upon us, we say." So ends the quote. I think that Halevi's description of the sukkah is moving and evocative. These transient structures have sides that are left open. Sometimes all sides are left bare to the world, such as the one on the picture and on the front of your order of service today. Intimate with their surroundings, they do not wall anything off. It is a structure of radical openness and also of vulnerability. It may be helpful, I think, to contrast the sukkah with another structure that may help to highlight its meaning. We might think here of a fortress with reinforced walls and weaponry to repel any outsiders. The sukkah is the opposite of that. Open to both the world and the people in the world, its boundaries are permeable and exposed. It presents not enclosed certainties, but rather open possibilities and hopes for connection. Letters to My Palestinian Neighbor was written at the time when the relationship between Palestine and Israel was becoming increasingly bitter and in many ways disintegrating. Halevi tells the story of crossing the border between Israel and Palestine before he wrote the book. It was the late 1990s, and he wanted to foster a connection and to learn from his neighbors. And so he spent time with Sufi mystics and imams and Palestinians who desired intercultural exchange and interaction. He writes that there was more hope then, more possibility of connection, maybe even more possibility for shared goals. But since the Second Intifada in 2000, the wall went up and the possibility of crossing it, either physically or metaphorically, diminished. Not only physical walls, but perspectives became more entrenched, more oppositional, more difficult to traverse. Now, I have shied away from preaching on this conflict for a long time. The list of grievances on either side is long and difficult to completely address. It sometimes feels as only the total victory of one side or the other could possibly answer for all of the injuries that have been inflicted. Further, when I hold up the stories of the Palestinians and the Israelis side by side, it's not long before I see intractability. Each has its own narrative, its own understanding of land and people, its own way of viewing the world and the particular historical situation that it finds itself in. As the arguments get pushed, the likelihood of lobbing painful charges seems inevitable. Words like occupation, colonialism, racism, genocide, and ethnic cleansing start to be used. Some of these terms used by both sides. The possibility of any conversation appears lost. The sukkah is exchanged for the fortress. When injury is involved, concepts can serve as defenses for us. They can serve as walls to prevent us from being vulnerable and laid bare to injury again. In some circles, any claim that Israel has a right to exist or should exist, that it has some unique relationship with the land that served as home to its ancestors, is met with angry retorts of chauvinism, racism, and colonialism. Likewise, in some circles, any mention of Palestinian suffering or any challenge to Israel's actions are met with suspicions of anti-Semitism. This was the case when the former Harvard president, Lawrence Summers, insisted that such claims, and I quote here, are anti-Semitic in their effect, if not in their intent. Both such readings collapse the situation and the people and their pain, their sufferings and their lived experiences into identities and concepts that can then be rejected out of hand. When an individual assumes the identity of the person that I fear or that I loathe, I can then choose not to see them, to deny their suffering and to deny their humanity. Judith Butler is an American philosopher who has spent a considerable amount of time thinking through this dilemma, and she has been a companion for me here. Specifically, she writes about grievability, about the capacity to see and to hear the suffering of the other. Ideologies, she insists, often try to foreclose the possibility of recognition, of empathy, of grief for lives that are lost. For some lives, she writes, public grieving constitutes an offense against the public itself. She catalogs a long list of people who fit that description, including the Vietnamese during the Vietnam War, gay men during the HIV/AIDS crisis, or families who have died during recent incursions into Iraq and Afghanistan. She calls this a violence through omission, where the public tolerates brutality and death by making that brutality and death unspeakable and unseeable. The conflict between Israel and Palestine seems to fit that description in many ways. Many people refuse to recognize losses on the other side, to recognize what's at stake for the lives on the other side, because they fear doing so will delegitimize their political claims. Halevi writes that this is based on a fear that giving any inch on the part of the Israelis will endanger the existence of Israel as a whole. Such failure to recognize is then mirrored by the Palestinian government, where giving any recognition to Israel's legitimacy is thought to endanger the claims of the Palestinians. And so there is this vicious cycle where the very prospect of humanizing the other, of recognizing their pains and their losses, becomes something of an offense and an insult. But if there's anywhere that I'd like to stake my claim this morning, it would be here on this fragile prospect of humanization. This is because a tremendous amount is at stake. It is nothing short of the survivability of life. It is whether human dignity will be respected in this instance or whether it will be lost in the intractability of a conflict seemingly without end. It is whether human life can be revered or whether it will be vanquished in the midst of these competing stories and narratives that justify opposing historical claims. It is whether human dignity will be venerated or whether it will be abandoned in the midst of insults and injuries that appear to justify retaliatory efforts. It is whether human dignity will be venerated or whether it will be crushed by theological claims that are only too happy to sacrifice individuals for their cause. It is whether human dignity can be respected or whether it will be suffocated by the political and media disputes that argue without end and without reference to their effect on human lives. It is what is at stake here is not just concepts and abstractions, land and historical claims, theologies and ideologies. It is rather the survivability of human life and the preservation of its dignity. But if abstractions and concepts, claims and disputes can efface our humanity, and they certainly can, then I think that the good news is that humanity can also be the place where a new encounter becomes possible. This is because life and suffering have a concrete reality that the abstractions of theological claims and geopolitical considerations do not often share. In other words, the reality of suffering can jar us into a renewed presence to one another. Both Yossi Halevi and Judith Butler, whose practical politics are different in many ways and in many ways are on the opposite side of this issue, agree that recognition and humanization is the place to start, or perhaps to start over, because anywhere else is likely to end in the same intractability and conflict. But the reciprocal recognition of one another's humanity, of one another's suffering up close and personal is different. It's a different beginning. It is a new possibility. As Halevi puts it, can we just for a moment admit that we have imposed the worst historical nightmares on each other and then agree to see each other as two traumatized peoples, each clinging to the same sliver of land, neither of whom will find peace or justice until we make peace with the other's claim to justice? What if it starts there? Not with walls and defenses, with concepts and claims, but rather with the recognition of shared pain and humanity, parallel traumas and losses. Is it too much to ask that dignity and life can be foregrounded in our deepest disputes with each other? What if we asked each other, in the midst of these most painful disagreements, what is it that hurts most for you? What is it that you have lost? Who is it that you grieve? And one last question. Would it be possible ever to imagine a structure with fewer walls and rather with openings on all sides?